These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University.
Get down.
Welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, Maurice Jackson on Esther Cooper Jackson. Africa World Now Project is next. It is without hyperbole to suggest that Esther Cooper Jackson is one of the most important organizers, thinkers, writers in the history of the world broadly, the Africana world specifically for over eight decades. Her intellectual contributions, her insight and foresight, her writing, her ability to organize organizers, her kindness, her love for and hope in Black people, her modeling of radical care for intentionally extended community and her family, her vision to see beyond the parameters of now, the moment, are all foundational to what Robin D.G. Kelly calls freedom dreams, as well as the clearest articulation of what Amilcar Cabral called for all revolutionaries to commit, that is, class suicide. For Maurice Jackson, Esther Cooper Jackson was the soul of Black folks, the soul of humanity, the salt of the earth. From her days at Washington's historic Dunbar High School to Oberlin, and to Fisk University, she fought for equality. From her co-founding of the Southern Negro Youth Congress, she is a warrior for justice. During the fascist-like McCarthy era, she stood as a woman of enormous courage, where she and Jack devoted themselves to each other, to their daughters, and to the great cause of their and our time, through thick and thin. Hers was a life supreme, where throughout her century plus 5 years, she emitted love supreme for humankind. Nothing could be finer. Frick Chapman, executive director of the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, who met Esther Jackson in 1963, just 2 years after he had been wrongfully convicted and sentenced to life and 50 years in a Missouri state prison, told People's World, "What inspired me to write her was a fellow prisoner who gave me a copy of Freedom Ways." 3 years later, in the summer of 1966, Freedom Ways published an article Chapman had written titled Science in Africa. Chapman further reflects that Esther helped my case getting national attention. It was also the beginning of a relationship with Esther and Jim Jackson that stayed with me throughout the time I was in prison, 13 more years after 1963, and until now, almost 58 years later. For Chapman, Esther Jackson is a long-distance warrior for freedom. In this meeting, Esther Cooper Jackson, Robin D.G. Kelly reflected that when he visited her in her Brooklyn apartment, by this time he had already met with James Jackson and spent time in the South, he was prepared with pointed questions and detailed information. But for Kelly, what he remembered the most was that during this initial meeting, she began by interviewing him. She wanted to know who he was, who his people were, why on earth was he interested in communists. Reflecting further, Kelly recalls being particularly struck by the description of the cadre of young Black radical couples in Birmingham who worked consciously to eradicate sexism within their households. Esther talked about how she and her husband, Ed Strong and Augusta Strong, Lewis and Dorothy Burnham, attempted to share housework and share child-rearing activities, as well as public speaking and organizational leadership. Unlike so many other social justice organizations, the women were not chained to mimeograph machines. As Esther explained to Kelly, then the men actually thought that to be a good communist, you struggled on the women question. Esther Cooper Jackson completed her thesis in 1940 and it caught the attention of renowned sociologist Robert Park, who offered her a fellowship to work on her PhD under his direction at the University of Chicago. Cooper, however, turned it down and opted instead to work for the Southern Negro Youth Congress in Birmingham. She intended to complete her graduate studies one day, but she got, quote, busy organizing the South. Nevertheless, Cooper's thesis titled The Negro Woman Domestic Worker was a part of a larger discussion in politically progressive Black women's circles and in the African American community generally about the plight of female household workers. Black periodicals during these years were filled with probing articles on this subject. The chance to organize in the South and to materialize her commitment to racial justice and democracy was for Cooper just too good an opportunity to pass up. To be sure, Cooper never abandoned her interest in writing and intellectual analysis, as best displayed in co-founding and serving as editor of Freedom Ways magazine that creatively bridged politics, culture, and activism for a quarter century. In this light, her master's thesis stands as an important early development in the making of a Black radical activist intellectual who helped usher in the modern civil rights movement. Cooper's thesis, along with the writing and activism of Black women on the left, foreshadowed arguments made by Black communist leaders and theoreticians such as Claudia Jones, who argued that after World War II, Black laboring women constituted the most exploited segment in the African American community and in the U.S. working class. Therefore, Black women, not industrialized white workers, represented the vanguard of the working class. It is here orthodox Marxism and traditional approaches to labor organizing were turned on their heads, suggesting radically new ways in which to theorize race, gender, class, and politics while promoting social change. Ideas that were further developed after the late 1960s by the Third World Women's Alliance, Combahee River Collective, Angela Davis, and bell hooks, amongst others. Esther Cooper Jackson's range of thought reflects the depth of her understanding of the role of Black cultural production as an essential component of the Black freedom struggle as well. Jonetta Richards highlights this when she writes in Fundamentally Determined, James E. Jackson and Esther Cooper Jackson at the Southern Negro Youth Congress 1937 to 1946 that, as an organizational secretary for the SNYC, Esther Cooper spent a good deal of time managing the Association of Young Writers and Artists. The prospectus of this association stated its purpose as, "The long struggle for freedom and citizenship has been the central aspiration of poets, writers, artists, and in the day-to-day lives of millions in the cities and on the farms in the South. This story will be written and sung, painted and dramatized. It is a story that spans 300 years into the past and stretches into the future." Gerald Horn adds to our reflections on Esther Cooper Jackson, stating that she was part of an astonishingly excellent cohort of Black women of an earlier generation, including Claudia Jones, Shirley Graham, Louise Patterson, and Dorothy Burnham, who is still with us, fortunately, at the age of 108, who will serve as role models and inspirations for all of us, but especially Black girls, for generations to come. Angela Davis, previously reflecting on the role of the concept of legacy in relation to James and Esther Cooper Jackson, suggests that we must take the time to ask, how might we define legacy? What is our relationship to the past? What are our negotiations through history? How do we manage different and sometimes conflicting temporalities? Legacy could be defined in two ways. One, a gift by law, especially of money or some personal property. Two, something transmitted by or received from an ancestor or predecessor or from the past. In both instances, there is an assumption that somehow the past is securely segregated from the present. Of course, in law, the originator of the legacy must first die in order for it to be transmitted. Professor Davis adds more sharp clarity to this frame, adding that the civil rights movement had to be declared dead in order for its legacies to be celebrated by the dominant culture. These legacies are also represented as individualized rather than collective. Individual figures transformed into icons become the signs of these struggles. Davis points to the fact that there has been no attempt to assimilate the legacies of the Southern Negro Youth Congress into a so-called triumphant narrative about American democracy. There's been no attempt to assimilate the legacies of the Communist Party, at least not explicitly, precisely because these legacies of people like James and Esther Cooper Jackson and those with whom they worked and struggled for so many decades point to unfinished agendas of freedom. The Jacksons and their comrades fought and continue to fight for freedom that could never be assimilated into a project of U.S. global domination through war and torture, through the wholesale denial of human rights. Davis, reflecting further on her relationship to the Jacksons, writes that it is not a scholarly relationship. My relationship to the Jacksons is personal and political. And in thinking about my connection with them over the years, I realized that I cannot undo the entanglement of the personal and the political. Elaborating on the realization of the connection between the personal and the political, Davis highlights an excerpt from a letter Esther quoted in her pamphlet, "This Is My Husband, Fighter for His People, Political Refugee," written on the stationery of the Tobacco Stemmers and Laborers Industrial Union, which Jack had helped to organize at the export factory of the British American Tobacco Company in Richmond, Virginia, while Esther was still at Fisk. Jack writes, "Already, I have missed the glorious Fisk hospitality, and most especially your contribution to the joyous stay I had there. Of all the happy memories of my trip, acquaintance with you will stand out in bold outline. A native unselfishness, a will to serve and to sacrifice, an ardent devotion to our cause symbolized in the youthful beauty of a charming lady. And that's Esther to me." Davis writes further, "This passion, personal and political passion, so entirely intertwined with each other that it would have been impossible to separate the personal from the political. I think about the extent to which Esther and Jack and all of their friends and comrades, Dorothy Burnham, Louis Burnham, the Strongs, my mother Sally Bell, who were involved in the organizing of the Southern Negro Youth Congress, were totally driven by this personal political passion. Those who have been fortunate to meet Esther Cooper Jackson, whether personally, politically, or indirectly through her legacy with Freedom Ways or related organizing work, must now, more than ever, intentionally ensure that generations to come meet her as well. We all must listen to Esther Cooper Jackson's instructions more closely now, developing an ear to hear deeply. Listen beyond the dominant narratives that distort the ability to develop a clear analysis of the relationship between the past and the present, with a clear vision of the future. Next, we present a recent conversation with Maurice Jackson where we reflected on the life of Esther Cooper Jackson, her thought and practice, as well as her impact on his personal and intellectual development and organizing activities. Maurice Jackson is an associate professor who teaches in the History and African American Studies Department and is an affiliate professor of music, focusing on jazz at Georgetown University. Before coming to academia, he worked as a longshoreman, shipyard rigger, construction worker, and community organizer. He is author of a range of peer-reviewed articles and book chapters, as well as Let This Voice Be Heard, Anthony Benesset, Father of Atlantic Abolitionism, co-editor of African Americans and the Haitian Revolution, Selected Essays and Historical Documents, Quakers and Their Allies in the Abolitionist Cause, 1754-1808, and DC Jazz, Stories of Jazz Music in Washington, D.C. He has lectured in France, Turkey, Italy, Puerto Rico, Qatar, served on Georgetown University Slavery Working Group, and is a 2009 inductee into the Washington, D.C. Hall of Fame. He was appointed the inaugural chair of the D.C. Commission on African American Affairs, where he presented an analysis, African American employment, population, and housing trends in Washington, D.C. in 2017. He is currently completing work on Halfway to Freedom, The Struggles and Strivings of African Americans in Washington, D.C., to be published by Duke University Press. His next projects will be We Knew No Other Way, The Many-Sided Struggle for Freedom, and Black Radicalism, A Very Short Introduction. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descended communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all peoples. Listen intently, think deeply, act accordingly. Enjoy the program.
So I got a call in, an email from Margaret Burnham. She was in Boston, Judge Margaret Burnham, who was Louis Burnham's daughter, and just telling me that we need to call Esther. So we called her from Qatar, and then we had been away, so we got back, and we decided, and then Lena had gone up to see her, so we decided we needed to go. Laura and I went up, and she didn't recognize Laura, but she recognized me, mainly because of the voice, and I spent so much time with her. And it's been a lovely hour or so with her. And that was 2 days before her birthday. She died 2 days after her birthday. So we were just very happy that they've been many times. If I've had friends and I probably should have kept in closer touch with them, and I didn't. And then all of a sudden they're gone. Mm-hmm. Didn't happen much, because most of the time when my friends get older, so like I do keep in touch. But I'm so glad that we were able to spend that time with her. So.
Yeah. And just for, I guess to kind of, structure our conversation, for a more wider audience, can, mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about Esther Cooper Jackson's background, like, you know, where she comes from. And
because
we really want to build a conversation around, you know, an intellectual history, but also how it was impacted folk around, who were the people, the institutions, but also eventually we'll definitely kind of get to how she and her husband impacted you as well. But talk a little bit about, you know, who she was.
Let me first say how I got to meet Esther. I first got to meet her, it's the early 70s, I think it was around 74, and they were having a big anniversary of Jack's birthday. And of course, people like that, James Jackson, people like that, you know, the reputation had preceded them. So I was young, I had left Fisk, I had gone to Washington. I was seeking out the Communist Party, but you couldn't find it because everybody was underground, so to speak. Anyway, I went up there and I met them, and then we had the same last name, but not related. We both were from Virginia. And then next thing I know, whenever I was in New York, I was always staying with them and got to know Esther. And in a way, she became like a mother. And so I constantly, in staying with them, heard stories. And there were many stories about Esther, but the one that most impressed me, the one that I just stuck with me, was that in the years in Birmingham, she went down with the Southern Negro Youth Congress. She went down, Jack went down, Louis Burnham and his wife, and Ed Strom and his wife, and they all went down. And Esther would get up every morning at 4:30 or 5, and coming to her house would be Hosea Hudson, the great Hosea Hudson, the steel worker. And she basically taught him how to read and write by coming over. And they were extremely close. And here's this erudite woman from Virginia and this man who had gone through so much during that period. And then, of course, the Cold War came. And they all stayed in the house. And Coleman Young is there. And often I would see, sometimes I'd run to Coleman Young. And he'd be in the presence of Esther and Jack. And, of course, they'd reminisce about those days. And Coleman Young had gone, you know, in a different direction. So Esther is first to me an educator. And, of course, she was from Arlington out here, but in those days, the schools weren't very good, so she came to Dunbar, which was the premier high school in America, bar none, black or white, a public high school. And she came from Arlington, so she'd have to pay, and so she stayed with an aunt. And every Monday morning or Sunday night, her father would bring her in, her and her sister Paulina, and then on Friday nights, he'd come and pick them up and take them back out there. Her father was a military man, her mother, Esther Cooper, who had worked with many women here in Washington and worked with Miss Burroughs and Nanny Helen Burroughs and others. That's what she had come for, working with the Training Institute. And so Esther had that background, then, of course, on to Oberlin, a school in the Underground Railroad. And then from Oberlin, got a fellowship to Fisk. And at Fisk, she was there working on her thesis that you've spoken about on the relationship of domestic workers. And was offered a fellowship to go and study at the University of Chicago. Had worked, you know, with Charles Johnson and others, but decided that she had been smitten both with the movement and by a man named James Jackson. So they ended up going to Birmingham. And then from that, she was always a great writer, but she found her calling to work in the mass production of ideas. And as you know, she became very active in a campaign to free Niecy Taylor, which is post-Scottsboro, and the rights of Black women workers. And when you talk to Esther, just the names that people come out, you know, a conversation about Elizabeth Catlett, conversation about Thelma Dale, a conversation about all the great leads of Walter Washington, who was the mayor of Washington, of Coleman Young, and so many others. And then later on, of course, we get to that, she takes a role in the international arena. But like so many Black women at that period, when their husband goes to war and the children are born, they become primary, you know, breadwinners. So one has to work. And she, you know, worked in New York State, many things like that. But during that period when Jack was over in Burma. And you read the Sarah Risbeck's her great book on the life between these two people. And when I first joined the movement, it's very interesting because I had never, my mother and father separated when I was very young. Maybe a year old, I went and stayed with a foster parents for a couple of years. Wonderful people, very hardworking railroad people. But I had never until I was very young then, I went to live with my grandmother down south for many years. But when I first started staying with Esther and Jack, it was really the first time I had seen a married couple, you know, a per se, worked together. And of course, their kids were grown by then. I was grown, early 20s. But it had such an effect on me just listening to them talk about child raising. When our kids were born, I took them as a, I often said I had three models. It was Esther and Jack, who were much older. James and Miriam Early, who were, you know, who had older sons, and James Steele and Brenda Steele, all had three sons, and I became very close to all of them. Jim Steele became like an older brother to me, and I see him all the time, and they had, they were very lucky. They were raised in households with fathers, and so was Jack, so I could hear these stories, and that let me know the type of father that I would want to be. In Esther, of course, was so different from my mother. My mother was just a hardworking woman who just didn't get the opportunities. And my grandmother, certainly none. And so Esther was that. So Esther had this appreciation of domestic workers when she started writing about that. And I was raised by a grandmother who was not a domestic worker because she refused to go in white people's houses. So she was a washerwoman, just washing clothes. I said, but it's very similar. She was very independent. She was her own boss. And that's mainly because she did not want to work in these white people's houses, but she washed their filthy laundry. So consequently, I don't know how to cook. Because my grandmother didn't believe, she just wasn't a very good cook. But I could out wash and iron clothes anybody. I could. I don't do it now, but I used to iron and starch all my shirts. I can. So certain lessons you learn, and the appreciation of a different form of domestic work, and that's what Esther, you know, put her life into. And then, of course, what separates, really puts her out there, is when she writes this wonderful pamphlet, "This Is My Husband." Jack had gone away, fought in Burma. They had been away from the family for years. She's raising the family. First, she's a mother. She's raising her daughters. And then Jack comes back from the war, and he and Esther finally back for a period. And the McCarthy period comes quickly. And Jack, because he's a leader of the party, has to go underground. And Esther's raising these kids while she's working. And it had a traumatic effect on her children because the FBI is following them everywhere. Following to school, trying to get them kicked out of school, going and gossiping. But, you know, I was in the Communist Party for many years, and I remember when I left the Communist Party, you had two different trends. You had the FBI going out spreading lies to try to keep from getting work, and you had people within the Communist movement, because you've left that spreading lies. And this is during a period when you had those two trends differently. People, the FBI, and then people who had been in the party, but who became, for better word, finks. They started turning on everyone. And a lot of people left the party out of principle, but some didn't. They left out of fear. And so, but they were all these different trends. Well, Esther wrote this magnificent pamphlet called "This Is My Husband." And she talked about not just the question of husband, but on Black women. Now, at this time, Claudia Jones had written this phenomenal work on the role of African-American women. And Esther comes back and reiterates this with the role of African-American woman, not just as worker, but as worker, as mother, as intellectual, as thinker. And she had a great influence on people like that. And then, of course, in the process, she had known the great Du Bois. She had known Robeson. You know, Behold the Land, this great conference that was held when Du Bois gives this a great speech held in Columbia, South Carolina. And with that lays to the formation of the ideas of later basis, some years later, of Freedom Ways Magazine. Now, this was not easy because Esther was still, you know, Jack was the communist leader, Esther around, and the communists wanted her to make this their magazine. But Esther resisted that. This was the magazine of the people. And of course, you know, having been in the party so long, it was a mixed bag. Some organizations, there was great flexibility, but even if anybody, if you were in the party, they want to control how you work within that organization. Those are the principles that were established there, but they were to be more independent, more flexible with that each person. But what Esther found was that some of these whites, including some of great bigotry, wanted to tell her how to run her magazine. So she quickly established that as an independent magazine. Even sometimes if Jack, her husband, may have disagreed with her on certain policies. And it was interesting because they always had principal discussions, never arguments. I remember once they differed about, because when Alice Walker's Color Purple came out and Jack wrote a blistering attack, and it became, you know, he probably shouldn't have written it the way some of the stuff was true, but it came across so blistering against Alice Walker and that it created such a schism within the whole But Esther was able to handle it. Jack had made a mistake. He some of the things were correct, but he should have placed it quite differently. But in that sense, she was a great defender of the rights of women. And I think you saw the Boston Globe comments of Angela Davis. Angela Davis, of course, her mother, Sally, and her father, Frank, were very, very active in the South. In the South, if you lived in the South, you had to make a choice. One person had to make a living. One person could be the spokesperson. And so while Sally Davis was a schoolteacher, she was able to work. Her husband, Frank, is the one who had a gas station independent of this. Rosa Parks had her husband, Raymond, who worked. And Rosa Parks was able to be a seamstress. And as you know, Angela, years later, when school is bombed, she goes off to Elizabeth Irving School in New York. At any rate, Esther plays this role of leading woman activists, leading Black woman activists, but she also is probably the greatest talent, you know, scout. And in fact, while I never heard her say it, I imagined if Toni Morrison were today, she would have to say, living today, she'd have to say she saw how Esther discovered talent, because as you know, she was the first to publish the big books by Angela, and then Muhammad Ali's biography, and all these things became so great. But Esther, and when she found this magazine with the support of Du Bois and the support of Paul Robeson, and this is the period, of course, when Paul Robeson is being persecuted because of his ideas, when Du Bois, right before Du Bois gets his passport back, but they're taking this, they're persecuting all those. It's not an easy period. And of course, at the end of this, many of the communists are still in jail. Henry Winston is still in jail. Her husband is still underground. But they found this magazine as sort of a third way. And immediately, it has a big impact because it comes in the concurrent of two of the big events in modern history, the civil rights movement in America and the movement to decolonize, especially African colonies. And therefore, she becomes the first to publish Nkrumah. And Nkrumah, of course, had known her husband, Jack. He had known Langston Hughes and all those from his association with Lincoln University. And consequently, in concurrence with the founding of this, is Du Bois leaving America and going to Ghana. And then he dies, of course, on the eve of the March on Washington. But Esther is right in the midst of all this, publishing some of these first pieces.
No, it was interesting. I mean, we'll pick back up. There's a famous picture of her and Jack sitting with Du Bois as he's preparing to go to Ghana at this particular time. And this is when, from what I understand, Du Bois is giving membership to the Communist Party.
Yeah, so what happens is that Jack actually goes with Du Bois to Ghana. And it's very interesting. There's a wonderful picture of Jack going with Du Bois to China to meet Mao Zedong. There's another interesting picture of Jack going to meet Ho Chi Minh. And, you know, Jack is very light and mustache, so he could pass almost anything, and he goes there. Well, anyway, Du Bois gives Esther this letter. And this letter is his letter where he's going to join the Communist Party. And it tells her, hold it. Gives the Jack, but Esther is the one who was the gatekeeper. You know, give the Jack, he might get lost. And so he writes this letter to Gus Hall, the general secretary of the party, and he leaves it with them. And he goes to Ghana, and in Ghana, he decides that he wants to be let released as he also renounces his citizenship. And I remember Esther and Jack saying, they said, Dr. Du, do you really want to release this letter? And he says, I said, release the goddamn letter. And of course, they release it. And it's his last statement against U.S. imperialism, we should say. Whether he do that today or not, I don't know. Mm-hmm. But he goes there and and they play this major role. And of course, Shirley Graham had written, I have the books up here, she had written and published in Freedom Ways before around the same time, because she has published children's books. I have a book up here, children's books on Booker T. Washington, others on Robeson. And so she became, and you know, she had lived in Egypt for a while. So all this internationalism is another thing. Esther had traveled to to the World Youth Congress or something for us, and she had been there, and she and Jack had both been to India, and they were so deeply affected by the independence movement in India. And there they got to meet people from all of these countries, from South Africa and others. So the world, in a way, became their oyster, and they became children. They were already children of Du Bois. And Jack had known Du Bois because whenever Du Bois went to a certain town, you know, people stayed with, they had no hotels to stay with. So he stayed with, you know, the Jacksons. Esther got to know him a little bit later as she's working, and Du Bois moves to Brooklyn. And they, in fact, give Du Bois furniture from their house that is too big. Jack had furniture from his mother's house in Richmond, and Esther has some furniture, and Du Bois has moved in. So he tells a story about giving Du Bois his great big bed or something they had, because it was too big. They lived in a 21 St. James. In fact, I remember this, the phone number is out of existence now, UL71718UL73744. And just remember, because I called it so much, 21 St. James Place, in apartment 15M, right across from Pratt Institute. So there was this great closeness with Du Bois. Then they would tell stories about Du Bois and Rose. And Du Bois usually go to his house. Du Bois is a man of great discipline. He'd smoke one cigarette for dinner, have one drink of cognac. If you're talking, he's going to bed at 10 o'clock. Now, you can keep talking if you want to, but he's going. Robeson, come to your house, talking, maybe have a sip or two, and he'd go there, go to sleep on the couch. But that's Robeson. You see, the, just the difference of people. I can imagine that I've thought about it. I could have, you know, many conversations later at Robeson about anything, sports, music, culture. But Du Bois was a bit different, culture, high culture, and things like that, but just different. And Esther was a cross between them both, highly intellectual in the sense, talking about many of the issues, but also in keeping grounded with the realities of, and she kept her husband grounded in a certain sense because Esther is on the ground. And then, of course, Esther sees, I think, before a lot of other people, especially a lot of radical, the importance of this Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And some of the communists were a little reticent because they were different. They didn't bow down to the past. They made mistakes. They make mistakes like the Black Lives Matter movement makes. They thought they were the only ones who had ever struggled before anyone else. But they learned to grow. And in fact, I've gotten some very nice correspondence from some SNCC members who knew how close I was to Esther. And they said, and one said almost, she served as a model for me. And I never thought I'd hear this, but she did because of this work, especially around editing and getting out the truth, because you have to put this stuff down. In many cases, even in the movement, it may have been whites who were writing, even in the party and other things. But here, Esther's, the blacks would put these ideas down themselves. And they did not have to correspond with anybody existing in the ideology. They didn't have to correspond with the Marxist idea. But they had to be pro-independence. They had to be pro-black. And she, as you look at their tour board, she brought in different people, John Reed Clark. But she had room for those different, because Clark publishes anything, and you know, he becomes very anti-communist, very anti-Marxist. But it's okay, because some of the things he's writing about are true. So she can bring together these currents in such a way that there's a model for the modern movement.
And it's very important, because one of the things that you said, and we wanted to talk about this, you know, funny, when you had a chance to talk to Esther, you did the names and the relationships. One of the things that you get very, very clear, and you mentioned this in your thoughts about Harold Cruz. Harold Cruz is crisis.
Harold Cruz.
And of course, which goes into my statement or my thought process specifically, is the fact that she was a true organizer, being able to move through these different variations, these conversations, these discourses with clarity and fluidity, but also is able to really see how these ideas are moving, you know, in and out of each other, informing each other, pushing each other, you know, those types of things. And, you know, here I'm thinking about, you know, the Pattersons, the Robesons, and also someone that you know very well, Jack O'Dell, who comes to, you know, this, you
well,
know, talk a little
bit
more about
that. It's very interesting with Jack O'Dell. So Esther was, this, of all things, organized. And so, you know, they had this apartment, and I would often stay in Jack's study until it became too crowded. But Esther had her little office. She had an office, Freedom Writers Office, but she had an office in the bedroom, and just so neat and so much to everything and ideas. And I remember that even before I had met her, when I came to Washington, I dropped out of Fisk. I'd gone to Antioch, and in Antioch, you had to have internships. So my internship was at SCLC, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And then I stayed on there to work. And working there was Dave Clark, who became the head of city council, Ann Holloway. Ann Holloway becomes Andy Young's person on African affairs, and she goes to the UN and works with Andy Young. And then she goes to Mali and becomes an ambassador. And she asked me to go along with her. Would I go? And of course, I said, "And I doubt if I got security clearance, but I think I'd do better here." Well, I can remember sometimes the phone would ring, and I got to know her, and it would be Esther Jackson. And she's looking for Jack O'Dell. Well, Jack O'Dell, out of Detroit and out of New Orleans, but Jack O'Dell had been a seafarer. So I called him Jumping Jack Flash, because Jack would move. He's always moving, ideas with notepads and brilliant man. But he's not staying one place too long. He's moving. And it's hard to catch up with him, you know, because Jack O'Dell had worked with Dr. King and, of course, Hoover, asked King to force out O'Dell and Stanley Levinson, which he does have to. But then again, O'Dell's ideas have so stuck with Du Bois that when he writes his speech, you know, to the Freedom Ways Dinner in 1968, when he speaks about this, and he speaks about the role of Du Bois, but he goes back to Du Bois' Marxism. He shouldn't be criticized all that. Well, Jack O'Dell is, of course, the one who's helping to construct those ideas, so to speak. And so Esther would often call looking for Jack, and then Jack would, because Jack has an article he had to read, he had something. Jack's expertise becomes expertise in international affairs. You know, educated man, but a lot self-educated, as a lot of sailors are. And at Antioch at the time, when I was there, Jack O'Dell was teaching there. Bob Rhodes, who became a supreme Marxist theoretician, Victor Perlow, James Jackson, and Jose Hudson. Well, Esther had taught Jose Hudson to read and write. So Jose, he could read and write, but you know, he's not reading and writing at a college. So Jose would come there and give lectures, and I would write them out for them. Or type out, my typing wasn't, but I could write them out. And then if he wants a book, he wants to find some, I'd go and find the materials on the book. And he was always so pleased. He said, "You have to show this to Esther," because Esther, and Esther was, and I'll tell you a story about why I went to study 18th century instead of modern history. So Esther would look at this, and then when Jose would come to town, he'd go to Esther's and she'd have dinner for him. And Jose, of course, is a, it's so different than Esther and Jack. Jose is all working class. Oh, no, you know, barbershop quartet, all of that. But Jose, Jack and Esther weren't drinkers, but Jose liked his vodka. And at that time, Stoney Sky was just coming out. Nobody can buy it now because of the Russian invasion. But he wouldn't drink Stoney. All he drank was Vladimir. It was the cheapest stuff. So he called me Jackie. He called me, "Jackie, I'm coming in town. You got to have my chicken and my Vladimir." So I would have, and we just talked the night. But when he get to New York, the first thing he wanted to do was see Esther, and they talk about ideas. She'd show him some of his lectures, which I, some of them I had written out for him. I wish I'd kept them. And that, but I was her great student, this man who was older. And sometimes when they were all in Washington together, they would come. And they would have dinner, you know, at our house and things like that. So my wife and I, Laura, have great memories of seeing them together. And be very interesting. They'd be talking, and Esther and Jack would be talking. And Jose would say, "Shut up, young people, I'm talking." And he was older, but they were all older by then. And of course, in those days, you know, if you're under 30, anybody over 50 is older. And I got to be over 50 now, I understand. You have to change your attitudes. But Esther was that to so many people, young and old. And that's why Angela's words were so important. And that's why generations of young women writers and editors owe her immensely, as she owed her mother, as she owed Nanny Helen Burroughs, as she owed Anna Julia Cooper, as she owed Mary Church Terrell. And she would always say, sometimes I slip and I say, "Terrell." She said, "No, it's Terrell." She always said that you have to make sure you pronounce, and they both were products of Oberlin College.
And what is interesting, and let's just back up just a little bit to talk about, you know, she was very interested in the 1960s SNCC, but, you know, this is also coming out of a tradition, you know, her and her comrades and collectives doing the Southern Negro Youth Congress, right? So talk a little bit about, you know, that particular formation, you know, her role in that, and also how that links specifically to her being very interested in, you know, SNCC in 1960 as well.
Okay, well, the Southern Negro Youth Congress, of course, is founded in the tradition of the National Negro Congress and others. And they're founded in with college people on college campuses, and Jack becomes a leader very quickly. Thelma Dale, who's out of Washington, D.C., and then Lou and Dorothy Burnham and Ed and Louise. And these people, these couples become so close in the work. And they just worked themselves. In fact, people generally say Louis Burnham probably worked himself. He died early of a heart attack, just like Charles Hamilton Houston did. They just work all constantly for this and work and worry. And they found this group mainly in the South, of people with different ideological views, and it takes such courage. You know, I often joke, you know, Malcolm X talked about Martin Luther King and this and that, but I often joke, I said, Malcolm talked this stuff, and Malcolm didn't go south. So he stayed and he can talk about it as he's paraded by all these. So, and not that he wouldn't go south, I suppose, but he didn't, at least didn't go there. So it's a big difference. So you can talk about, but Kwame Ture and Cortland Cox and Marion Barrow, they went south. June Johnson, Dory Ladner, all those who I've gotten to know so dearly are here. Well, so when they formed this organization, and it was during a tough time, just during a time of open lynchings against Blacks, about 80 a year. It's a time of open terror. And they have the courage there to go down in Birmingham, before it becomes Birmingham. It is still a very brutal place. And they are there, and they go, and then Jack goes to Louisiana. They go in all these states, the organizing workers, the organizing textile workers. In South Carolina, talking tobacco workers in Richmond, they're doing these things concurrently. Jim Jackson, Chris Austin, who later goes to Detroit. But of course, then the war comes, and the war, you know, disperses people there. And then right after the war becomes the, you know, the early Cold War period. But during this period, the Southern Negro Youth Congress becomes the premier. And these formations are forming all over, as you recall. In South Africa, it's a bit different. Because you formed the, you know, the ANC has formed, but it's formed differently because it's formed, but ANC forms on a model after the NAACP. And so you have anti-apartheid organizations that are modeling themselves after and coinciding with the SNCC. And then they become very active in the international movement, especially as the war trends are developing. And look at the people that develops out of it, a Coleman Young, a Chris Austin, a Esther Jackson, a Burnham, Thelma Dale, who leaves Washington, D.C. and goes to New York. Associated with them, Elizabeth Catlin, people like that, the artists. Associated with them are Charles White, artists, and people like this who go and make phenomenal contributions throughout the world.
And so she brings this, you talk about Elizabeth Catlett, you're talking about the cultural aspect, because a lot of what, you know, the Southern Negro Youth Congress was doing was using culture as a political, educational foundation to really teach subversively in the context of just a very violent structure in the South, right? We're talking at the height, this is 1937, 1940s, early 1940s. This is a very important period where they are learning and on the ground how to educate or use political education as a real forceful tool. At the same time, she's bringing these skills to Freedom Ways, right? She's bringing these skills as a foundation.
She's bringing the Freedom Ways. You know, perhaps one of the first great articles I wrote, I read was about a Max Roach writes, something in Freedom Ways. He also writes in Black Scholar. Tom Porter wrote an article about freedom and jazz. And so a lot of people writing about that. So you're getting these jazz writers. Archie Shepp, you know, writes a piece about the love of jazz and music and these. She's giving all artists exploring. But she also publishes others. She's publishing Neruda. She's publishing Nazim Hikmet, the Turkish. She's publishing Sean O'Casey. She's publishing all of their descendants. So all of these ideas, African poets and playwrights, Maya Angelou and many others are coming there. So to read, be able to read these. In fact, I had the Smithsonian did not have a full set. So luckily I had a full set of them and I donated my set to Smithsonian. They don't take a lot of, you know, because to the African-American Museum, but readers will be able to go there and just get every volume right there. And each volume was donated to a different, dedicated to a different thing. One on Africa, one on the Caribbean, one on the South. Jack O'Dell becomes one of the first Blacks that I know of who's writing about solidarity with the Palestinian people, long before it was popular. Understand that up until around the mid-40s and 50s, African-Americans and the Jewish people are allies on many, many things. The NAACP, Spingarn and others go and join. The Rosenwald schools, where Samuel Rosenwald makes donations to found these schools. And there's a lot of agreement. But of course, some schisms comes with the establishment of Israel, not an establishment of Israel itself, which Ralph Bunche and others supported, but with the putting of the Palestinian peoples off of their land and a wanton treatment of it. And then, of course, the big other disagreements was the question of affirmative action, which many of our Jewish brothers and sisters believe was unfairly giving blacks an advantage. I've often joked, I've never seen a black person give an advantage towards anything, nothing that I know of. But it's also true, if you look at history, and as I tell my students, there's not one thing in American history that hasn't aided black people, that hasn't aided white people just as much. Reconstruction, public schools, public hospitals, affirmative action. I tell my students, they say, well, how's it helped me? I say three words, ask your mama. And you see it right there, Title IX in education. Well, Freedom Race brings up all these things. Freedom Race has the first big discussion about the Bakke case in Illinois and the right and the attacks against affirmative action and others. Freedom Race has some of the first articles about, again, as I said, about decolonization, but from the people themselves and great artists, an issue dedicated to the dramas, to the arts, issue dedicated to music, to theater, and so many published there, you know, the development of Alice Walker and many others, like the Shange. And then Brunswick becomes the cartoonist, and they have great cartoonists, Elton Fax, and so many others are drawing, and they're using art. And then one has the magazine. Like today, I have on my wall at work, Time Magazine, some other magazines have Breonna Taylor, and they'll have a Michael Brown and others like that. Well, Freedom Ways was the first to do that. And so people would buy the magazine and even frame the magazine and put it up in the house. And so many other people are supporting. Harry Belafonte becomes a massive a supporter. As I said, you know, Max Roach, Abby Lincoln, they're all these jazz figures are publishing, especially of Shep, who's also Archie Shep, who's also writing poetry. And then to get many of the early writers, Goodman and others, Ruth First, people in South Africa, people who they've met overseas, who are brought to become the first to talk about. What people don't realize, sometimes it's distorted, that everybody became a friend of Mandela, but everybody was not a friend of Mandela's, even blacks. Many were caught between the PAC and the Mandela and the ANC. Many were caught between the fact that Mandela did not become anti-communist, that the ANC worked with colored people, the ANC worked with communists. You had all of this. Some did not accept that in Mandela at first. Later on, yes, because Mandela reached out. Mandela was very close to the South African Communist Party, Joe Slovo and many others. Many in our country, excluding some of the nationalist men, could not accept that. They had to learn to accept it. Mm-hmm. You know, when Mozambique is fighting, many were saying, well, you don't choose an MPLA, you have to give it, you need to just the same, but you need to, we find out what Herlin, Roberta and others were collaborating with the CIA. It's just simple fact. But some said you can't choose, it's a plague on both of our houses. And Freedom Ways never did that. Freedom Ways were able to take the right side. And looking at the, in the whole non-aligned movement, as you know, the fight between Warsaw and NATO and the non-aligned movement there, but Freedom Ways is the first to publish some of these independent voices, you know, of Castro and Chetty Jagan and some who were openly leftists. So Freedom Ways was able to see beyond the limited anti-communism that many black leaders had at the time and had to overcome. Mandela could overcome it, they could overcome, and they had to. But often people say they were right on these things, but it's just not true. It's almost like, you know, I remember she was one of the first to publish some of the ideas of Ali. A lot of black folks weren't digging Ali. They can say they were, but they weren't. You go into a barbershop, you'd be fighting this strange religion, they would say, and they would be supporting, you know, Frazier and others, and until Ali popped him, what's my name? Frazier didn't say it, but he wanted to say it. But the first to publish, you know, Ali and defending Julian Bond, when a lot of people didn't defend Julian Bond. So Freedom Ways had those principles, and you just have to go back through the volumes and see in hindsight. I often tell people, I said, you know, you have to really look at the history as it is. If everybody who said they went to the March on Washington went, you'd have had 10 million people. But the fact is, they had about 250,000. Some people went, and some people just didn't have the courage to go. The courage maybe is not the word, but maybe some were fearful, and some, but many were supportive of it and saw the importance, you know, of that, whatever movement. And that's the truth comes out. The truth also comes out about things like this, that all did not hold these notes. Vietnam, when she publishes, when they publish Freedom Ways, publishes King's Time to Break Silence. And of course, King is in a bind. because many black preachers don't want him to speak out about this when he goes to clergy and laity concern. Because if he speaks out about it, Johnson is threatening them. Look here, you come out against Vietnam, I'm cutting these economic programs. And King had to make a decision. And the black preachers, a lot of them are angry when he makes this, but he makes it in freedom where he has the courage to publish these ideas. King always, that's why on February 23rd, 1968, he was the one who gave the 100th anniversary speech. And he spoke about of Du Bois, and he spoke about the vision of freedom ways in seeing all these international and the local being the national in all of this.
And, you know, you mentioned carriage and, you know, that particular, you know, and that's not just a judgment on people, but, you know, as when you look at history, there is a reality. There is something that one can justifiably use as a frame of reference to assess behavior, because there is, yeah, you know, there's a thought there. And so, you know, there's also the fact that Esther Cooper Jackson understood personally the relationship between anti-communism and anti-blackness, right? This idea, could you talk a little bit more? You mentioned it briefly, because a lot of times we forget, or people miss the fact, or they will look at as someone like Esther Cooper Jackson and look at these points, right? Look at Freedom Ways, look at SNCC, but she's working, you know, organizing and doing work consistently, you know, even in these particular years, basically like with the young folk, or what we say is like holding it down, right? Holding it down, you know, for a particular, you know, because she sees something beyond the struggle. She sees something else. Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, I think that may have been a bit different than Esther and her husband. Her husband, Jim, is so ideologically motivated. He's I learned so much from him in the reading of the texts of Marx and many others. Esther sort of loosened herself from those confines and was looking at it broader way. And so in a way, she saw in the youth something that maybe old others hadn't, those more tied in. And of course, if you a leader of a communist movement or something like that, as a husband was, you think everybody's supposed to follow you, but everybody's not going to follow, but that's what you think. And you think, you're right. Well, Esther saw beyond that. And she saw the racism of the left more so than others. She saw the racism that existed within the Communist Party. She saw it when some who were ideological leaders wanted freedom ways to work under them. And she said, no, this is independent. And therefore, she had to go out and raise all the funds about that. But when she saw this talent, she saw these young people, they didn't necessarily agree with everything, just like we may not agree with everything at Black Lives Matter. And therefore, the Black Lives Matter movement really faltered itself. And I read a lot of this stuff when they haven't read the history of SNCC, or they haven't read the history of the student of Southern youth. And people in SNCC, a lot of them did not look at the role of the Southern Negro Youth Congress. Now, it's very interesting because if you recall, Stokely Carmichael's closest friend is Dennis, and Dennis is the one of his closest friends. Dennis is the son of Eugene Dennis, who was the leader of the Communist Party. So Stokely had grown up with all this. Stokely didn't necessarily have this anti-communism element. He had grown up in New York. He had grown up with communists. He'd gone to school with them. And even when he abandoned SNCC, leaves SNCC, he calls himself a follower of what the Panthers say, Marxist Leninist Mao Zedong thought. And he develops, and then he developed this close relationship with Tico Ture. And of course, some of the SNCC people go in a close aid with Inouye. But Stokely, as I saw it, was not bound for some of these elements of anti-communism, as some were. And some of it was out of fear. Some of it was about of anti-white sentiment. Some didn't believe that whites and blacks should unite together. And so often I tell students, you can say what you want, but there's not a movement in America of blacks that hadn't succeeded without some support of whites and vice versa, but it's done more. You just needed that because civil rights, whatever it is. And, you know, I remember seeing some people upset because the white women in Oregon who carried Black Lives Matter, supposed they got publicity. They were upset. Why are you upset? Don't be mad at them. Be mad at those who don't support it in that sense. But the importance of white supporters, and SNCC, NYC always saw it. And therefore, when they saw people like Viola Louisa and Goodman and Channing go down and give their lives, this is in the tradition of white people that had come out of the tradition of Esther Jackson, of James Jackson, and many others. It's an American tradition of trying to unite the peoples of races and colors.
So this notion of the centrality of the working class is very, very important as well, because being able to see this broad spectrum also shaped, I remember having conversations with Esther Cooper Jackson about this notion of civil rights and human rights. So, and I remember saying, you know, specifically, she was like, no, we always saw this as a human rights struggle as far back as, you know, we're talking, you know, her developing, and because this notion of a broad spectrum movement becomes, but the centrality of the working class, but also the centrality of Black folk in this particular struggle kind of leads or kind of colors or guides, you know, a lot of her work that leads her obviously to develop a relationship, of course, with Paul and Icelanda Robeson, right? You know, this notion. Could you talk a little bit about that relationship?
Well, yeah. You know, a lot of that comes from, you know, her work was on the role of domestic workers there. And she saw that. She started studying the trade union movement. And she saw that some of it was fraught with racism. But what she also saw is what a lot of people in the South maybe see a little later. What I saw is that she also saw good white people. And if you grew up in the South, chances are you don't see that many. I remember growing up in the South, and I don't think I ever. And I remember the first white person I ever had a conversation with. Now, this is in the 70s. You run Antioch College and people around the movements. Well, Esther, in working with the Southern Negro youth, had worked with progressive whites. There have been many whites who joined with them. As she talks about them, the Doors and many other people like that. And then they had gone off and worked in Detroit. And Jack had worked there, but she'd also been working with workers there and worker education. So she saw the role of the white workers. And then they had lived in Richmond in the role of tobacco workers, most of them Black, but some white. And then they had seen the importance of the United Front and fascism, you know, founded by Dimitrov and others, and the role of workers there, but workers with broader forces, with broader alliance, workers and artists and things like that. Then she saw the role of artists for labor, secretos, and all of these. And so she really early on saw that that not only could Blacks not win it alone, but if they were to win many of these struggles, they needed allies of the advanced class. And advanced class was the work class and trade union movement. And of course, as we know, one could say with the one, if you look at the great battles in America, if you look at Lincoln's calling for a 1941 boycott of in Washington, and then the March on Washington, the fact is that a lot of this was funded by two elements.
That was A. Philip Randolph.
A. Philip Randolph, 1941, right. when he wanted to call a demonstration because Roosevelt won't integrate war industries. And then of course, Roosevelt makes some pleas along with Mrs. Roosevelt. And then 1961, instead of 63, they re-up this. But who supports this? The biggest funds come from the labor unions, the buses, the churches, the labor unions. She always got the poor.
Due to time constraint, you can listen to the entire program on Africa World Now Project's SoundCloud. Just search Africa World Now Project. That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at AFWRLDNWPRJ. Instagram at Africa World Now Project. Access to our other media platforms can be reached through the bios of our social media. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist Moise Muntali, Africa World Now Project media correspondent Funa Ngonda, senior research content contributor and production director Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior research content contributor and production associate Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, content contributor and filmmaker Kurt Waterson, technology advisor is Byron Gray of Grayworks Technologies. And creative directors, international creative and artist designer Tabassum Siddiqui and Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project can be heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcast service of Winston-Salem State University. Programs are archived and available on all podcast platforms. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.